Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Bruce Fronin. He is the Ella and Ernest Fisher Chair in the College of Law at Ohio Northern University. He has a long history of research and publication and activity. His 2016 book with Harvard University Press, co-authored with George Carey, is Constitutional Morality and the Rise of Quasi-Law. He's also the co-editor of American Conservatism and Encyclopedia. Today, we have another co-written book that is on the table. It's called Coming Home, Reclaiming America's Conservative Soul. So welcome, Professor Fronin.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
All right, you begin with a powerful announcement of distrust among the American people, one that amounts to a civilizational disease. Strong words.
And deserved, I'm afraid. We've seen, just in the last couple of years, a breakdown of the most basic understanding of what it is to live in a republic. The spectacle of an entire political party denying the legitimacy of its president, whatever they may think of the person.
It's extraordinary.
And it shows, I think, on both sides that there's a lack of that mutual trust. You know, Aristotle called it a form of friendship that's necessary for people to maintain its way of life, and certainly crucial to a Republican people to maintain its freedom.
You know, one thing that you single out as essential to that freedom is in the sentence where you talk about this disease. A civilization is diseased, you write on page Roman numeral 9, a civilization is diseased when its people lose faith in its essential ideals and institutions, and when its elite loses or distorts its historical memory. I think you're absolutely right about that there. How do you think they have distorted the historical memory? I guess that's the topic, the big topic in the book, right?
Right. And I think it's just an entree to it. The book is not a discourse on President Trump and problems there, but you can sort of see the problem rise with the reactions to the idea of making America great again, because much of the response to that has been America was never great.
Right.
And that's simply a symptom of something that long predates the recent kerfuffles. It's really rooted in a counterculture that goes far beyond the 60s as well. It goes to a hostility toward our patrimony, the view that those who founded this country should not be seen as great men who sought to do their best to found a nation worthy of a self-governing people, but instead as people who stole the land, who destroyed pre-existing peoples, whose only goal was to line their own pockets. This kind of self-serving cynicism about our own past is deeply unhealthy, even as it is deeply wrong. It's just not accurate. It's become a way to gain power for oneself, because if the past doesn't matter, then we're not bound to follow its prescriptions. We can make things up for ourselves.
You know, we wonder, or we're dismayed, whenever we get the NAEP results. That's the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the nation's report card, as it was called. U.S. history is one of the areas in which they administer those tests. And 12th graders, whenever they take that test across the country, more than half of them score below basic in the grading scale. That's an F that the kids get. But when you think about how much of what they learn about American history is negative, it's ridden with guilt. Well, that's not something that you're inspired to remember. It's not something that you're going to take and absorb as your inheritance. And you guys are surprised that young people and increasingly older people don't know very much about the founding, about the Civil War, and so on.
Right. And it's deeply troubling, because the more that we give increased power to educrats to fix this problem at the national level, the worse it's going to get. Because the more power they have, the more they're going to be pushing their own agenda rather than introducing people to the great story that is America.
Is this why you say, this is a few pages further on, the most dangerous and effective outside power in America goes by the name of progressivism.
Yeah, there is an ideology that's existing in America that's become increasingly powerful, that is not tied to historical reality, that has as its goal to strip from us our past, to leave us, as we say, homeless, on our own, facing a state, a national government that is going to create an existence for us, that will keep us safe, that will make sure we feel good about ourselves, that will, in essence, structure our lives for us. This progressivism, which has some homegrown elements, but is foreign to the basic tenor of our tradition, is behind that march through the institutions of the universities, now of even the primary schools and of the bureaucratic agencies, that's created a very significant number of cadres of people who are committed to creating something fundamentally different in America. No longer a nation of self-governing communities, but a nation of individuals, of atomistic individuals who can be guided properly by their betters.
You know, you put it a moment ago, you said, talking about how the state can make us feel better. That's the assumption. There's a nice sentence along that line where you say, having lost the experience of self-rule and self-reliance, today's alienated citizens find it easy to surrender their hollowed out communities in exchange for the life of quote-unquote liberated dependence promised by the tutelary state. That's a nice little term there, that contradiction, liberated dependence promised by the tutelary state. What would an example of liberated dependence be?
Well, if you look at the goal of most so-called liberals today, it is of an individual person who gets to do whatever he or she wants without suffering the consequences, without taking any risks. So if my goal is to become a woman, the state should pay for that. If my goal is to pursue a way of life that doesn't provide me with any income, the state should take care of that, right? It's absolute freedom, including from the consequences of my own actions. But of course, what that means is that the state is supporting me in everything that I do. And if the state should decide that there's something wrong with my actions, which is to say, if I fail to buy into the whole long list of politically correct requirements that are put on us these days, I'm going to suffer for it. And I honestly believe that is, in fact, where we're heading. And not all that slowly.
You know, I think it's extraordinary how the aggression has accelerated just in the last couple of years. Mm. And it's almost as if the election of Donald Trump kicked it up a notch, sometimes to levels of hysteria. And the redefinitions of discrimination, the redefinitions of hate, and the willingness on the part of people who feel like their liberation, their liberated dependence, is threatened, well, we're going to go after you for that.
Right. And I think there really was a sea change under the Obama administration, not because he was so effective. It was, thank goodness, he was not a very effective or hardworking president. But because he gave such cover, because he was clearly one of this new class who believed in a post-Western notion of culture, it freed people in the various heights of our culture to truly be themselves in a much more radical fashion. So we got at a speed which I don't think anyone expected. I fully expected that the Supreme Court would decide that same-sex marriage was required, but I did not expect it to happen as quickly as it did. Things happened very quickly under the Obama administration because there was a feeling of freedom that they were now in charge, that progressives now would bring the new Atlantis, so they would bring a new world to us. And I think there's just a great deal of anger at the idea that their rightful place has been taken from them.
They really do come across sometimes as children who've had their toys taken away. Those are their toys. we are the right people to be in charge. And we finally got in charge. Now, I remember on college campuses, the kind of realization, the historical realization of the academics, because they felt Obama was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, we are where we are supposed to be. We are at the heights of intellectual power, and we're now at the heights of political power as well. And to have someone like Donald Trump, who violates every one of their intellectual norms, as well as their politics, it's too much. It's just too much for them to take.
Yeah, you add the idea of him being a vulgarian to it, it makes it just unbearable for them, I'm afraid. But mostly, I think it's that they thought they had this locked down. I mean, it's been mentioned before, but a pretty famous Marxist teaching at Harvard Law, Mark Tushnet, did a blog piece called The End of Defensive Crouch Liberalism, in which he said right before the election, it's time. It's time for mopping up operations. It's time to no longer give these folks quarter. We won. They lost. It's time to bring it home.
Right.
And the fact that right at that moment where they thought they were going to be victorious was taken away from them, that's going to bring a great deal of angst. And the nature of what was in store for us is all around us, because the fights are still going on. The Masterpiece Cake Shop case, I think, is a very good example of it. They want us out of the public square. You cannot sell cakes unless you're willing to sell cakes that celebrate a form of marital union that goes against your deepest held religious beliefs.
Is there any point at which the progressives will slow down? Will they pause at any point?
Well, Venezuela. Because the thing about, I learned this from one of my professors in graduate school who was himself a socialist. He said, the problem with liberalism is everything is good to do. And the problem with thinking that the government is in charge of making the world perfectly fair is it never will meet your specifications. So there are always things to correct. So we can start talking about, are you using the proper pronouns or not? It becomes a form of soft totalitarianism. It's been commented on more than once. And this is why revolutionaries tend to eat their own, because there's no point at which we achieve the hoped for end, in large part because this kind of governmental rule is attractive to a certain kind of character. And it's not a terribly pleasant term, but I think it's the most accurate one, of the crybully. That is, the person who says, you've oppressed me, therefore I get to punish you. And because there is no proper stopping point, because we can never be purely fair, there's no point at which the regulations will end other than through some interaction with reality.
Yeah.
Now, one hopes that one form of that reality will be a response from normal, sane, traditional Americans. That's the hope, that we don't get so far that we will, in fact, throw off this form of rule. And that's the situation we're in right now.
One of Jordan Peterson's points when people say to him, why are you against hate speech? Or why are you against hate speech regulations?
Sure.
And his point is, the problem with hate speech regulations is, who is going to establish and enforce them? And when you ask that question, you realize that the people who will end up doing this are the very last people you want to be in charge of this kind of administration, of where the line is and what you're going to do to people who cross the line. The people who want that kind of job, they're crime bullies, they're busybodies. They've got a huge resentment chip on their shoulders, and they're identity politicians. They're not impartial observers, that's for sure.
That's right. And the other thing that I'd like to add into the mix is that this busybody aspect has been very censorious for a long time, and it's often intentionally and pretty aggressively anti-tradition. Because one of the things that they've been doing for a long time is essentially treating any expression of religious belief in the public square as a form of hate. Right? The way in which the so-called separation of church and state is interpreted these days by the courts, and especially by the groups that seek to sue any expression of faith out of existence, is that there's something inherently oppressive about a creche, that any religious expression is somehow harming other people. And again, there's no place at which you can stop that until you have a purely, well, naked public square. But there's no such thing as a naked public square. So what you end up with it is a sewage-filled public square. You know, an eight-year-old can access hardcore pornography, but we can't have a nativity scene on public property.
Right. You say at one point that during the founding, one of the things that characterized conservatives as conservatives, you include Adams, Madison, and Hamilton here, is that they were suspicious of moral reasoning that avoided religious authorities. Jefferson, you know, in other words. And the Jeffersons have scored remarkable victories on this public square issue in the last 50 or 60 years. Do you think it's slowing down, or we've got chances of reversal coming in?
Well, there's always hope because, you know, as Burke said, man is a religious animal. They are, and it's an ideology, which is to say that it's a second false reality that they're attempting to impose upon, you know, the natural order of things. So you see, and I'm sure you've come across the number of polls where you see that millennials actually are more open to religion than their parents were. There is really a hunger out there that I've seen among my own students for some kind of understanding of, I hate to put the word higher power, but I'm afraid it's so inchoate among many of these students because they were brought up completely without religion.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an openness to evangelization that does give reason for hope. And I think it's up to us to capitalize on that. I mean, the state cannot really promote virtue in any substantive sense, but the state can protect the institutions that promote virtue. Right now, the state is attacking the institutions that promote virtue. That's what we need to correct.
The progressives, they want to. They're going after those institutions aggressively, and they know it. I mean, look, Bruce, I'll tell you, it seems to me that on the non-political institutions, the left, progressives have been so far ahead of conservatives on the takeover, the takeover understanding, that they, for instance, I've seen in hiring in academia over 30 years that I've seen a lot of hiring being done, conservatives will hire someone who is a good scholar, solid teacher, going to be a good colleague, but who's a liberal. They'll vote for that person. The left, they only hire their own. That's it. And over time, well, what happens is they come to have an outsized influence on the institution that they're in, and the conservatives sitting there wonder what happened.
Right. Apparently, we've been around about the same length of time. I won't ask any further into that. But what I've seen since I started is that in political science is where I actually started out.
Oh, yeah?
And
What you got a PhD in political science before going into law?
Yeah, I taught for a couple of years.
I noticed you got a law. You got your degree at Emory University, my institution.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you and Sam Nunn.
Sure. It was a lovely place. I love Atlanta. But I got my PhD at Cornell back in the late 80s. And I taught political philosophy for a couple of years. I finally gave up and went to law school because I was just so angry going through the hiring process. I was so tired of getting letters from members of committees asking me to sue them as if I could correct things. But you went from a time when I was in a department which had arguably three people to the right-hand side of the spectrum that is could vaguely be called Republican. Out of a faculty of about two dozen. None now. Zero. I mean, I don't think people realize just how much it's become the case that we simply do not exist at most relatively prestigious institutions now.
Yeah, and the conversations now are extraordinarily narrow. I mean, so many talks are just off the table. They don't even talk about them because they don't have to talk about them. This is just sort of unspoken wisdom. Now, progressivism is not something that is argued for. It's simply assumed by everyone because there's no one else in the room to challenge it.
Yeah, and it really is taken as an article of faith. It's become a new kind of religion, an ersatz religion.
What makes let me go to another topic. What makes Calvin Coolidge such a key figure in American conservatism? You single him out quite a bit.
Yeah. He was a man of American tradition. If you look at his character, the way that he was brought up, and what he tried to do as president, these all sort of fit together in comfortably within the American tradition and as a fine example of it. As a lawyer, I find it quite interesting that he was the last president who actually became a lawyer without going to law school. He apprenticed, which they all ought to do as far as I'm concerned.
He went to Amherst, is that right?
Yeah, but that was college.
He went to college at Amherst. Didn't he write his senior thesis on Aristotle's ethics?
You know your Coolidge. So. But he didn't feel the need to go to law school, even in the late 19th century.
Yeah.
Not everybody did. But he was committed to the principles and the traditions of self-government. When he talked about the Declaration of Independence, for example, which so many today take as a kind of abstract set of utopian ideals that have to be lived up to, regardless of the cost, he talked about it in terms of an opportunity for the people to govern themselves. And I think that's the way that it was intended. If you read the document, most of what it is specific charges against the king for violating traditional rights, traditional understandings. And he took that as part of the American tradition itself, that what we're about is not some specific set of policies. What we are about, what we've always been about, is people in their townships, in their communities, deciding for themselves what's best in a day-to-day, in their day-to-day existence. And he worked throughout his term and a half in office to reduce the interference that the federal government, even during his era, had in people's daily lives. Because, of course, he was living in the shadow of Woodrow Wilson, the founder of the administrative state. But it wasn't purely a negative idea. At the federal level, it looks negative. I often say, you know, at the federal level, I'm a libertarian bordering on an anarchist because I think we need to get rid of most of it. But that's not purely a negative set of goals. It is much more what the founders understood, which is that our life is in more fundamental institutions, family, church, and various local associations. And he worked for that tirelessly.
You know, you mentioned the Declaration and the Constitution. Did you notice that in President Obama's speech in Brazil, he talked about the words, "They hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," are in the U.S. Constitution? little mistake there, President Obama.
It's a good example of what Common Core can give us all.
You know, right after Coolidge, well, a few years after Coolidge left office, that's where we got the big fall that you single out, and that's the Helvering decision, correct?
Right.
What was that?
Well, it was the idea that there is no real limit on what the federal government can spend on, so long as it's for the common good.
So, yeah, the term in the Constitution is the general welfare, which before Helvering was understood to be in quite a narrow way, right?
Defense. It was defined, and here's the real point. The preamble of the Constitution is not supposed to be, it was not intended to be a grant of power. All it was a preamble. It was a statement of the general purposes for which the government exists. The grants of power are in the specific articles. Congress has the power to do, right? You have a vesting of specific powers in Article 1 for Congress, in Article 2 for the president, in Article 3 for the courts. There's no independent status in there that was intended for the preamble. And to say that somehow general welfare is a clause of the Constitution is really a travesty and a very damaging one. So it's pretty much impossible to simply point out today in the courts that there is no power to do something.
You know, general welfare, that's anything. That makes unlimited power. Well, everything's good for the general welfare. That's like what you said before. The problem with liberalism is that everything it does is good. Or all the good things one can do. There's no end to it. Let me get to a separate issue here. Later on, you said there's a problem in the training of young conservatives, and that is that they are, quote, without substantive education in conservative traditions. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are two different ways of looking at this. One is we tend not to know our own intellectual tradition anymore. The other is that because local government has become a shell of its former self, there's not a great deal of understanding of what Tocqueville called the schools of politics, right? These very basic interactions between persons. Today, rather than engaging in a combination of practical activities at the local level and engagement with their own history, we tend to be training young conservatives to be wonks and pundits, which is very much the progressive game. You don't have people learning how to actually make changes either on the ground or to understand, much more importantly, again, I come back to it's faith, family, and freedom. The basic institutions, the fundamental associations of cultural life. And without that engagement, your punditry and your wonkery are not going to be well-grounded. They're not going to be terribly useful.
I have to agree with you that I've seen a lot of very smart young conservative students, but they're pretty much law and economics, you know, contemporary business practices. They've got some Ayn Rand behind them, a little Hayek, maybe Hayek, but Edmund Burke, no, you know, John Adams, Tocqueville, a little bit at most, and I think that harms them when they go out to engage in polemic and intelligent politicking.
Right, and I think it gives them a warped vision of who we actually are as a people and of their own tradition. You see it a great deal even in the disputes that we're having among conservatives ourselves these days. It seems to be an argument over whether we should champion America's liberal culture or whether we should reject it, whether it's a matter of defending classical liberalism against basically socialists, the progressives, or whether it's all a huge mistake that's a rejection of God. And both of those views miss the dynamic within our tradition, that a conservative people is not a people that lives only within its churches. A conservative people is one that engages in forms of self-government. A conservative people engages with the world around it. And our tradition has always been fundamentally conservative, but with a significant liberal element. And those are two different things that historically, and this is the book that Ted and I are working on now, it's a great conversation that has shaped our politics and our public life. The opposition to unearned authority and power, which is, I think, properly associated with liberalism, is a good thing. But it shouldn't be allowed to become unhinged from the culture, which is fundamentally, right, you can see it in the Latin root, is fundamentally concerned with religion. The culture comes from the cult, right? The Latin root means to cultivate, cultivating the land and cultivating your soul.
Let me ask one final definition from you, Bruce, and that is you use the term right-wing liberalism. What is right-wing liberalism?
Right-wing liberalism is an attempt to salvage from a culture that is moving leftward the idea of limited government. It's a product of the pursuit by conservative institutions, conservatism Inc. is, I think, the pejorative, to win elections. And it's to say, you know, we're not these stuffy, terrible right-wing, altering fireside types. We just want freedom. And there's something to be said for it, but it's too thin. Right-wing liberalism just means good old-fashioned classical liberalism in a superficial, narrow sense. And it's echoing the other side. And it's doomed to failure in the long run.
Professor Fronin, thank you for joining us. Let me mention the book one more time, Coming Home, Reclaiming America's Conservative Soul. It's out with Encounter Books. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.